This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
Citizen outsider, and we'll talk a little bit more about how atheists and agnostics and non-believers and those of us who do not like to be asked to pray by presidents are still outsiders in our own secular country. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and welcome to Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. This is the September 17th, 2011 broadcast of Free Thought Radio. Radio for the rest of us. This show broadcasts from Madison, Wisconsin. Also podcast and broadcast over the air in Atlanta, Grand Rapids, Monterey, and New York City.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and we are the nation's largest association of atheists, agnostics, skeptics, infidels, whatever you like to call yourselves. We all disbelieve in the same God, and all of our members support the constitutional principle of the separation between church and state. FFRF has legal staff tackling violations all over the country in schools and government places, and we have taken more than 50 lawsuits. And we hope you will join us, and we hope you will join us at our 34th annual national convention in Hartford, Connecticut on the weekend of October 7th and 9th. And there's should be still time to get a hotel room. There's time to sign up with us at ffrf.org/outreach. Go to the convention link, and there's also all kinds of ads on our website.
Steven Pinker, Rebecca Goldberg.
Yeah, grab an autograph from Charles Strauss, who wrote Annie and Bye Bye Birdie.
Yeah.
Jerry Coyne,
Why Evolution is True.
He's going to talk about how religion and science cannot cohabit in the United States, and many other awardees and activists. And a good time will be had by all: our non-prayer breakfast, our moment of bedlam, the drawing for clean, godless money, Dan's music, mingling, meeting. So sign up.
So we hope to see you there. In a few minutes, we're going to talk with ACLU attorney Rebecca Glenberg, who, with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, filed a lawsuit this week challenging the illegal posting of the Ten Commandments in a public high school in Giles County, Virginia.
On the second half of today's show, we'll hear an amazing kind of chilling story of deconversion and betrayal. Our guest will be Seraphim. That's not his real name, obviously. He's an Orthodox monk who was just kicked out of his monastery this summer when he told his abbot that he no longer believes in God. This is a U.S. citizen. He'll tell us how he's been treated since then. He's been living in a homeless shelter and trying to put his life back together, and he's part of your clergy project.
The New Clergy Project. Last week, we talked about FFRF's letter congratulating New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg for planning the entirely secular commemoration of the 10th anniversary of 9/11. This time, no religious leaders were invited to preach or to perform rituals or to pray. The event, orchestrated by a secular government, was to be for all the people, not just believers. But a lot of believers complained about the exclusion of religion.
Bloomberg did hold his ground, as Dan put it in the blog you wrote about this, that was his ground zero. And it did all seem to be going pretty well. And we thought we could relax and enjoy, watch a respectful ceremony, when who should step up to the podium to inject religion into this secular event, even read from the Bible? No, it wasn't a priest or a pastor or even a pushy rabbi or a pushy, slick megachurch evangelist.
It was none other than President Obama, the leader of our secular nation. He decided to inject his own personal God into the public proceedings. This was insensitive to the spirit of the occasion. His entire remarks consisted of reading Psalm 46, which begins with the words, "God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble."
Come behold the works of the Lord, was made desolations in the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge.
Now, this wasn't his entire remarks. Actually, he preceded it by saying this would be a comfort, that this was a comforting passage. And so what's wrong with that picture, Dan?
Well, that verse that he just quoted says that the blame is on God. Come behold the works of the Lord who has made desolations in the earth. That psalm says God is a very present help in trouble, but we know our country's been praying, and we're praying on that day 10 years ago on 9/11 for God's help, and yet prayer was a massive failure. And why should Yahweh be getting the credit for being strong and powerful when actually it was another God, Allah, who might be taking the same credit for the desolations on the earth that that Obama says this God inflicts on the world?
Yeah, which God is bigger if you look at 9/11?
Yeah.
Of course, there is no God. Now, we will switch topics to something cheerier, which is always cheery for us, is a new lawsuit. Not that we want to take them, but we know we will win this one. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker. Coming up, attorney Rebecca Glenberg will tell us about the lawsuit she and we filed this week challenging the Ten Commandments in public schools in Virginia. It's quite a story.
Find out more about Free Thought Radio and the Freedom From Religion Foundation at FFRF.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio. As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And we've talked before on this show about the situation in Giles County, Virginia, where the public high school has put up the Ten Commandments, then took it down after complaints, then put it up, took it down, and now they've installed it in a supposedly historical context.
Yes, Freedom From Religion Foundation brought those complaints on behalf of people in the area, and then others came forward. And then Rebecca Glenberg, our guest that we're going to introduce, came forward, and it is the new version of the Ten Commandments being challenged in federal court now. Rebecca Glenberg of the ACLU, in cooperation with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, has filed a lawsuit in the Western District of Virginia, Roanoke Division. And it was just this week, and we were hoping not to have to file, but we're very pleased to have on the phone with us from her office in Richmond, Virginia,
Rebecca Glenberg. She's the lead attorney in the case. So welcome to Free Thought Radio, Rebecca.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, this case started last spring, and we thought we had kind of resolved the case because after the foundation's complaints and your complaints. Why don't you tell the story about what happened?
Well, there's been a lot of ups and downs. First, they had posted for many years the Ten Commandments along with a copy of the Constitution, a plainly unconstitutional display. And after the Freedom From Religion Foundation complained about it, they took that display down. However, many members of the community were upset with that decision, but they managed to convince the school board to put the display back up.
And it didn't go, well, they made this decision, what, in July? We thought this was all solved and resolved.
Well, there were several ups and downs.
Yeah.
After they put it back up, they took it back down again after they
received advice
from their attorneys at Liberty Council, a Christian legal organization here in Virginia, that the display as they had it, the Ten Commandments along with the Constitution, was unconstitutional and that they weren't going to represent the school board if they continued with the display in that form. And then came the decision in June that they were going to post the Ten Commandments along with all of these historical documents relating to American history, like the Magna Carta and the Declaration of Independence.
So, I think it was in February. I can't remember now. I should have looked all this up. But a bunch of, it was really a church minister and flock stormed one of the early school board meetings. And that created a lot of consternation. And meanwhile, at FFRF, we were starting to get a lot of complaints from people in the community, including a student and his parent and other parents who did not want this to happen. So it's been interesting to see this courage, really, in the face of what was kind of hysterical reaction. But it was my understanding that religious right groups were still behind this latest attempt. Do we know what's going on with Giles County Schools? Are they claiming that they're going to be represented by a religious right group?
We don't know what the status is currently. Certainly back in February, it appeared that they were getting advice from Liberty Council, this group in Virginia. And it's not clear to me whether they received advice from Liberty Council regarding this latest display or not, or whether they're going to represent the school board in this case or not.
The Liberty Council had been fined, or they've lost cases in which counties have been fined, penalized for trying to put the Ten Commandments up. And there was a recent decision just in the last couple of weeks where a community had to pay so much money. It was Pulaski County, Kentucky, I think. So it's not a wise course of action. But why don't we talk about the strengths of this case, what's wrong with having the Ten Commandments in a public school anyway, Rebecca?
Well, the problem is that the Ten Commandments have the purpose and effect of promoting particular religious beliefs, and that simply is not the role of a public school. Our Constitution mandates that public institutions remain neutral on matters of religion, so that non-believers and those who have different religious beliefs are not made to be outsiders in their own school or their own community.
I'm looking at the complaint that you've drafted, which is really very thorough. The first big gathering was in January, and there was a lot of hysteria. But our complainant, the young student who's come forward, has to go by this display every day.
Yes, he goes by the display every day, and every day, therefore, he has to be reminded that Giles County Public Schools do not apparently view his beliefs as valid.
And we are going for a protective order in this case. Do you want to explain what that means?
Well, we're not going for a preliminary injunction. So we're not going for the injunction right away. But what we're asking the court to do ultimately is to issue an injunction, that is an order that would require Giles County Public Schools to take down the display that's currently in the high school and not to post any further displays of the Ten Commandments.
But we are going for a protective order to protect the identity of our complainants.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, misunderstood. Yes, our plaintiffs are suing under pseudonyms Doe 1 and Doe 2 just because the reaction of the community to this controversy has been rather extreme and hostile. They are quite rightly afraid of retaliation should their names become associated with this lawsuit. So we are asking the court to allow them to continue to proceed under these pseudonyms and to prevent the disclosure of their actual identities.
And I think we've carried coverage on Free Thought Radio, but this was the school where there was a walkout, for example. The students, isn't this the same school where they walked out with their Ten Commandments T-shirts and stuff like that? It was actually the students complaining that the Ten Commandments had been removed. So there's a lot of peer pressure.
Yes, and our student client tells us that as well, even before this controversy erupted, that he was aware of a lot of bad feelings on the part of students toward toward other students who did not share their Christian beliefs. And so, you know, he frequently heard Christian students telling non-Christian students that they were going to hell.
We've done this before. We got a protective order in a case in Tennessee, a federal case, and it was easy because students are involved. Children are involved in this thing, and the courts are very sensitive to that.
That walkout was in March, but things have been just going on all spring long. There were, for example, 100 citizens coming by the school board in May to support. It was a man, another man came forward, a Mr. Lilly came forward saying, let's put the Ten Commandments back up. So there's just a lot of community outrage about not having the Ten Commandments in the schools. Now, could you talk a little bit about Stone versus Graham?
Sure. Stone versus Graham is a United States Supreme Court case in which they held very clearly that posting the Ten Commandments in a public school was unconstitutional. That was a case where the Ten Commandments were displayed by themselves alone on a wall. And so it was very clear that the intention was religious indoctrination and that there was no religiously neutral purpose to the display. The court said that the display of the Ten Commandments is very, very plainly has a religious effect because the only thing that it can do up there is cause students to read it and perhaps be persuaded by what it says.
Now, I kind of think, I know Dan wants to say something. I kind of think it's worse that they've put the Ten Commandments back up with all of these truly historic documents, legal documents that have something to do, maybe not the Magna Carta is a bit of a stretch. I mean, that's a legal document, but not so much.
Because what does the Ten Commandments have to do with American history?
Right. So
I actually debated Matt Staber, who's the head of the Liberty Council at Liberty University School of Law last year, on whether or not the Ten Commandments are a basis of American law. And he had to back off and say, actually, they're not. But they influenced it. The Ten Commandments didn't show up anywhere in our founding documents, nor in the Constitutional Convention were they even mentioned. So to call the Ten Commandments a, quote, historical document is a joke.
Well, I certainly would agree that the Ten Commandments are out of place in that collection of documents that all have to do with American legal history. Unfortunately, the courts have had mixed opinions about this.
And, Van Orden, for example.
But not in a school. This is pushing the parameters.
But not in a school. That's correct.
Yeah.
Courts have upheld displays like this in courthouses, but not in a school, where the Supreme Court has said that students are particularly susceptible to indoctrination, and therefore you have to be especially sensitive to the possibility of their being indoctrinated by displays.
And actually, the Supreme Court in McCreary, was it 2005, said you can't put these displays up in a county courthouse, you know, the Magna Carta, Declaration of Independence with the Ten Commandments. It was clearly a ruse. And all of the recent litigation, most of it's in the Sixth Circuit, has gone our direction. So that's very comforting.
Oh, yes. And what McCreary said was that when you look at a display like this, it's important to understand the intent of the government officials who put it up, and that you look to the history of the display to help determine intent. And we think that the history of this display, where it started out with just the Ten Commandments and the Constitution, and then following community involvement and distress over the display being taken down, they decided to add all these other documents. We think that's a very clear history that demonstrates
yes.
the religious intent behind this.
And I
display.
Say you only have to read the first commandment, thou shalt have no other God before you, to know that should not be on classroom walls. The government has no business telling school children which God to worship, or how many gods to worship, or whether to worship any god at all.
Or what speech you can say, or what kind of art you can make, or what kind of, what day of the week you should worship. These are all religious edicts.
Well, we so much enjoy working with you, appreciate your work, and we want to do a call out to Patrick Elliott, who's the staff attorney who's going to be helping with this case, who brought the original complaints. And we hope to correct this violation in Virginia very soon with your help, Rebecca Glenberg. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. Coming up in the second half of our show for an incredible story. In a few minutes, we will talk with a recently ousted monk about the disgraceful treatment he has received and is receiving when he told his abbot that he no longer believes in God.
Hi, my name is Howard, and I'm from Warren, Michigan, and I'm on Free Thought Radio on a Saturday.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney. In my new play, Letting Go of God, I come out clearly as an atheist, absolutely committed to keeping church and state separate. Won't you join me and the Freedom From Religion Foundation in waking up America to the growing dangers of theocracy? Phone 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. That's ffrf.org.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And in the past few weeks or months, we've occasionally talked about this new group called the Clergy Project, a project started with the help of Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Linda LaScola, me, and others to help ministers, priests, rabbis, maybe we might have an imam joining us pretty soon, who have lost their faith or abandoned their faith and no longer want to preach and they want to get out of the ministry. And we're mixing up right now about 23 active clergy of various denominations with more than 50 former clergy like myself and Dick Hewitson and Paul Heffron and a number of others who are sort of it's like a safe house where we're comparing stories and helping each other with career changes, emotional difficulties dealing with family, and so on. But one of the most amazing stories that has come out of this clergy project, and we talked with Chris before, and we talked with Patrick before, and we talked with Jerry, who's one of our recent graduates on a recent show. But today we're going to talk with Seraphim, and that's not his real name. He doesn't want to use his real name for obvious reasons, because it's a very tentative situation he's in right now, actually a little bit scary. Seraphim is in the process of not becoming anymore an Orthodox monk, and we have him on the phone today.
In Orthodox Greek Church, is that what you mean?
Well, Orthodox, we're just going to say Orthodox and because we don't want to identify too much.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. So, Seraphim, welcome to Free Thought Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
So I understand you're sitting out on a park bench right now. Why aren't you in your home?
Well, if I had a home, I would be in it. But after 19 years of monasticism, I decided to leave and made a rather ungraceful exit. And unfortunately, don't really have a stable place to be just at present.
So what happened? You went to your abbot, and what did you tell the abbot?
Well, I had decided after many years of thought that I simply could no longer in good conscience remain in the monastery. And, you know, people leave monasteries all the time, and they very often simply get up and leave. They, you know, run away, essentially. And I wanted to avoid that. I wanted to do things in a diplomatic and gentlemanly manner. And so I submitted a petition to the abbot, simply asking that I be released from my monastic vows, and that I be defrocked from the rank of deacon, which is one of the orders of minor clergy, and also simply have my be released from my responsibilities until such a time as I could leave. And that was on a Tuesday in early June. And 2 days later, on Thursday, there was a knock at the door. There were two gigantic state police officers who escorted me out of the monastery, put me in handcuffs, and had me involuntarily committed to a psychiatric unit. And this was despite the fact that I was in no way a threat to myself or to anyone else. I was not, you know, having a psychotic episode. I was not delusional. I was not hallucinating. And I think I was as lucid then as I was today.
So why did they do that?
Well, I think, quite honestly, that they honestly believed that the only way that one could lose one's faith and express the desire to leave the church was if one had lost one's mind, if one had, you know, gone insane. There didn't seem to be room in his mind for rational dissent or for, you know, coming to disbelief through rational thought, through common sense, through consideration, through study. They must have simply assumed that, as I said, that I must have simply, you know, gone off the deep end by expressing a desire to leave. And
well, we've been called worse than that, I can tell you. But what was his legal authority? How can an abbot call in the authorities to do something like that?
He got the order of commitment signed by psychiatrists whom I had met once. Now, this psychiatrist didn't make any attempt to contact me during the time between Tuesday and Thursday. There was no visit. There was no nurse came by. It was all, he simply took the word of the abbot and signed the papers and, there came the police.
Because you'd been suffering from depression occasionally, is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, I certainly have had my struggles with depression, with an anxiety, a depression which I think was caused in large part by living a life that I found unbearable for many, many years, unable to get out.
A little joke. I suspect most of our listeners would be depressed if they were monks. You know,
right?
That's a depressing situation for you, especially when you've turned on the light and you can't get out.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's monasticism is a deeply unnatural kind of life. Particularly for a young man. As you know, I entered the monastery when I was 18. I'm now 37.
You're still young.
Yeah.
And you were smart. So
hopefully,
and you were educated. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's I think the point really is that it was my education which undid me. I entered the monastery at 18. After several years in the novitiate, I was sent to study, and I received a BA and then graduate degrees in theology and in philosophy. And it was in many ways the very sorts of critical thinking skills that, you know, a traditional Christian liberal education is supposed to give that, in fact, undid my Christianity.
Now, I think we shouldn't leave our listeners hanging completely. I do want to go back to how did you ever get into the monastery? Or I hope this isn't insulting. When I was a teenager, I used to call them monkeries.
Right.
A little joke. But what happened? I mean, how did you get out? You were in handcuffs, and now you're clearly out. How did you get your freedom?
Well, I was brought to a psychiatric unit in a hospital, and there I was examined, and they saw right away that there was no reason to keep me. But, of course, I had no interest in returning to the monastery at that point. I mean, whatever doubts I had about whether leaving the monastery, whatever doubts I had that was a good idea were resolved very easily. So in some ways, the whole situation, the whole circumstances of my exit, relieved me of any guilt or shame that I might have experienced otherwise. So I was there for several days until I was able to make contact with an old classmate from a secular institution, because really the only members of the social network that I had who were not involved with the church were former classmates. And so they took me in for a little while, but they were unable to keep, they were just about to move, and they had, things going on in their own life. And so I ended up in a emergency shelter in a rather unpleasant part of the downtown of a rather unpleasant city. And I was there for about 2.5 months.
Is that what you call the Bugs and Thugs place?
Yeah, I called it the Bugs and Thugs because those are the two things you can be sure to get to find there. It's mainly a dumping ground for parolees and people just out of prison, and it's pretty badly infested with bed bugs. But after about 2.5 months, I was able to move out of there and into a more kind of residential place that, the sort of place that euphemistically gets referred to as a home. And so I'm out of immediate danger, but certainly far from comfort or anywhere that I'd really like to be.
And your possessions?
Well, I made an attempt to get some of my things back. I made a very short list of some essential items that I could use. For instance, my laptop, some winter clothing, because, you know, winter's around the corner. You know, underwear, socks, a few things, shoes. And I discovered the hard way that most of my possessions, and many of these things really were my possessions, they didn't belong to the monastery, had in fact been given away. And my laptop had been physically broken. The hard drive was broken so that it simply wasn't working at all. I mean, it would start up and then freeze and shut down. And fortunately, with the help of a friend, I was able to get it fixed. But
you mean somebody broke it on purpose?
Otherwise, I've had to, you know, I lost my entire social network, or most of my social network, and nearly all my material possessions.
Your books?
You know, those are all gone. And to some sense, good riddance.
They were mostly religious, huh?
Well, yes, but, you know, perhaps I had rather too many of them, and so perhaps it's good to get a fresh start and learn to use libraries, you know, for what they're intended for.
When you said your laptop was literally broken, did you mean that somebody in the abbey had hurt, you know, deliberately broken your computer?
I doubt that very much. My guess is that it was just carelessness. That you know, most likely my possessions had been boxed up and in the process, things had gotten banged up, and, you know, computers, particularly laptops, are not difficult things to break.
No, we've...
So I don't...
Oh, I'm sorry. We have not heard how you ended up in a monastery in the first place at the age of 18. That's quite a story.
I come from a very religious family. My father is a priest, because within the Orthodox Church, priests can either be married or celibate. You know, unlike the Roman Catholic Church. Some of my earliest memories are from being around a monastery when I was 4 or 5. Then at the age of 14, I made my first attempt to enter a monastery, but I stayed there for about 6 months, and then I was declared too young to stay. And then when I was 18, I entered a monastery once and for all, and then went through the usual hierarchy of novitiate and then the Rosiform monk, which is sort of the lesser tonsure, and then the full tonsure and the diaconate. So that by the time I left 19 years later, I was kind of in middle management in monastic terms.
Now, when you say tonsure, you mean the shaving of the head?
Well, there's a symbolic cutting of the hair, but what they call the tonsure or the tonsure service is the service of taking vows.
Oh.
And so a fully tonsured monk is not so much a bald monk as it is a monk who's taken full vows.
You spent some time in Europe too, right?
Well, yes. I was, during the time between 92 and 2011, I was in two monasteries, one in the U.S. and one in Western Europe, and I would simply be at whichever one, wherever I was more needed. So it wasn't 19 years continuously in one monastery. It was 19 years between two monasteries, and with a few years somewhere in the middle, studying full-time.
Yeah.
Now, before we take the break, why did you want to become a monk when you were 14? Why did you enter a monastery at age 18? You were raised in a very ultra-religious family, I take it, and what was your goal?
Well, particularly in retrospect, I wonder how much I decided to become a monk and how much my father decided that I was to become a monk. So that's, of course, I mean, an issue that is complicated and we don't have time to get into, really. But besides that, I mean, monasticism is really quite central to the Orthodox Church, much more so than in the Roman Catholic Church. And, of course, you know, in Protestantism, for the most part, there is no monasticism. But, you know, if you're part of a religion which really believes that this life is nothing but a preparation for the next, and that the whole point of earthly existence is to prepare for judgment and for either eternal heaven or eternal hell, then it seems natural to sort of sacrifice this life in preference for a better life in the future.
Because this one doesn't matter, yeah.
Well, this one is just is sort of a preparation for the next one. And, you know, that's a very, I think, dehumanizing perspective, but it's one that really was the perspective of historic Christianity until very recently. I mean, I think now many people would be embarrassed to put it in those terms, but I think that that's really what you get from the New Testament and from, you know, most of Christian history.
Well, and almost all the spirituals, and Dan, you believed that too.
I did. I went into the mystery because I believed it. We have to take a break here, Seraphine, but when we come back, I want you to tell me what you were talking about before the show about how dysfunctional life is within the monastery. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We're talking with Seraphim, that's not his real name, a recently escaped monk. We'll be right back after this break.
Find out more about Free Thought Radio and the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio. Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
And we're back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And we've been talking on the phone with Seraphim. That's not his real name. I understand it's a name that a lot of monks take unto themselves. Seraphim has been kicked out of the monastery he was in, in the order, in the religion he was in, the Orthodox, for 19 years. He's now in his late 30s, and he has nowhere to live. And we've been listening to his story. And a question I have, Seraphim.
We should say he wasn't. He wanted to leave, Dan.
Yeah, he did. Yes, yeah. but the decision was made rather abruptly, as we heard earlier. Just very briefly, in about a minute, what were some of the intellectual reasons that you abandoned your faith?
Well, I mean, I don't really think that I abandoned my faith. It's more that the faith abandoned me. Hmm. I simply found it increasingly untenable. But in terms of the sort of more intellectual or bookish or cerebral elements that went into my faith unraveling, the central one was really coming to terms with the findings of biblical scholarship, and particularly in terms of the Old Testament. That is, what do we really know about the origins of the texts of the Hebrew Bible, when they were composed, who wrote them? You know, and I simply found it impossible to recognize the really unassailable findings of scholarship with belief in the Bible as scripture and as the source of all doctrine.
Well, I went through that same process, you know, and when your whole life is based on the reliability of that document, then what else is wrong with your faith? So, well, I think it was very brave what you did, talking to the abbot and expressing your views. But you were disappointed not only in how you were treated. Of course, that was brutal. That was just a gross injustice to your person. But looking back on it, what was life like in the monastery? Was it a bunch of nice, friendly guys peacefully singing songs together, or what was it like in there?
There were a couple of nice peaceful people, but. You know, a good image of the monastery is to compare it with the swan. When you watch it from a distance, it's gliding along very smoothly and looks like an icon of peace and calm. But if you look just under the surface, there's a whole lot of furious paddling going on. And, you know, if one visits a monastery for a day or two or even a week, it all seems rather otherworldly and beautiful. But once you actually get into it, and you know, you begin to realize that monks and nuns are really, for better or for worse, not all that much different than other people. And one would expect that, you know, in a Christian institution, people would be behaving in a Christ-like manner, in a manner with, you know, love and charity and forgiveness and, you know, all-encompassing, all-embracing love. And what one finds, and I think this is not true just of monasteries, but of churches and missions in general, is that people's behaviors in Christian institutions is really not so much better than people anywhere else in the secular context. And if anything, it can be worse because they can cloak their hypocrisy in Christian virtue.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, everything they're doing is for a greater good, and, well, the means for getting to that greater good are secondary.
And maybe institutions like that attract a higher percentage of people who are otherworldly. In other words, their mental state might not be quite as on kilter.
Well, about the sexual abuse things? Did things like that come up?
Yes, that's very much a reality. There is kind of a whole culture of sexual predation within Orthodox monasteries. And, you know, the Orthodox Church, unlike, say, the Catholic Church, is not centralized. You could call it polycentric. That is, there are all kinds of overlapping jurisdictions within America, for instance. And as a result, when people misbehave, or when monks or priests or bishops misbehave, and their authorities begin to come down on them, what very often happens is they simply jump to another jurisdiction or start their own jurisdiction.
And musical
so
chairs.
There's actually a website that I would encourage people to look at. It's called pokrov.org. I think it's org.
The what?
Pokrov
what
is the Russian word. P-O-K-R-O-V dot either com or org, one of those.
Oh, Pokrov.
Pokrov is a Russian word meaning protection. And this website, you know, documents these kinds of sexual predators that you do find within the Orthodox world and very much so within North America. And very often these predators are abbots of, or, you know, spiritual fathers, elders of monasteries.
They don't have to be celibate, do they, in the Orthodox?
Well, before ordination, one either needs to be married or be a monk. But one can't marry after ordination. So one needs to make the choice before ordination. Now, most of these people that I'm calling sexual predators are celibate. I shouldn't say that. I should say they took vows of celibacy. but... you know, of course, didn't live up to their vows. So it is a real problem, and the particular manifestation of it is a bit different than within the Catholic Church or within the Protestant denominations. But it is there, and it is very real, and I doubt there's anyone in the Orthodox world who doesn't know a victim.
Well, we're almost out of time here, Seraphim, and this is not your name. Well, that's a common name among a lot of Orthodox monks then, is that right, Seraphim?
Well, yes, it's from the nine ranks of angels. You know, there's the Seraphim and the Cherubim. And it just occurred to me after we did our little pre-interview that the first job of angels in the Bible is to keep people out of paradise. And that seems fairly appropriate.
Well, no.
But yes, Seraphim is a very common name, both among Greek and Russian and also Romanian, Serbian monks.
No, hell below us, above us, only sky, huh? We are out of time. I'm awfully sorry. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will stay in touch with you. I'm Annie Laura Geller with Dan Barker.
And we've been talking with Seraphim. We hope you find better living conditions in the months ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Brian Tarani, who's always quiet over there producing the show. Go to ffrf.org/radio for archives and the podcast.
Join us next week for more secular broadcasting and blasphemous radio, and be sure to sign up now for FFRF's 34th National Convention, October 7th and 9th in Hartford, Connecticut. Go to ffrf.org.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews. Brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope someday.